The headlines this hour: Russia and Iran reject U.S. claims that Moscow is blocking efforts in Vienna to revive the 2015 Iran deal. Ukraine announces a curfew in the capital, Kiev, at what it calls a difficult and dangerous moment after several Russian strikes on the city. Also in the headlines, an Indian court upholds a controversial ban on the hijab in classrooms amid renewed fears of discrimination against the Muslim minority. Welcome to our studios here in the capital, Tehran. This is News. Thanks for joining us. The Iranian foreign minister says the U.S. has to step back from its excessive demands in order for the Vienna talks aimed at reviving the Iran nuclear deal to be successful. Hossein Amir Abdollahian made the comments during a joint press conference with his Russian counterpart Sergei Lavrov in Moscow. The top diplomat said the interests of the Iranian nation are very important and that no party can stop Tehran from reaching an agreement in Vienna. Amir Abdollahian also said that there is no link between the current situation in Ukraine and the talks proceeding in Vienna. He then repeated Iran's stance that the war in Ukraine must come to an end and noted that Tehran is opposed to the Western sanctions on Russia. For his part, Lavrov said that Russia has received written assurances from the U.S. that sanctions will not hinder cooperation within the framework of the Iran deal. He also said Washington's suggestions that Moscow is blocking the revival of the Iran deal on trip. New strikes hit Ukraine's capital, Kyiv, as Russia's military campaign enters its 20th day. Several areas, including two residential blocks, have been targeted. At least two people are confirmed dead. Officials now say a 35-hour curfew will be imposed in the city, amid what they call a difficult and dangerous moment. Kyiv is surrounded from three directions. Russian forces have also been pounding other cities. Overnight shelling hit the airport in the eastern city of Dnipro. Officials say it caused massive devastation and destroyed the runway. Russia's defense ministry also says that its forces are now in control of the entire Kherson region in the south. Meanwhile, the death toll from an airstrike on a TV tower in a northern city has risen to 19. Russian and Ukrainian negotiators are set to hold the fifth round of truce talks as the military conflict between the two neighbors is in its 20th day. The Ukrainian president has described the latest round that was held on Monday as positive. Volodymyr Zelensky said Russia is already realizing it won't achieve anything by war. He added that Russian troops will be treated decently if they surrender. Meanwhile, the Kremlin says that it is too early to make predictions about the possible outcome of the negotiations. Talks over the war in Ukraine have been held between the U.S. and China in Rome. Washington is reportedly concerned that Beijing is providing military support to Russia. Max Civelli has more.
On Monday, U.S. National Security Advisor Jake Sullivan and China's top foreign policy officer Yang Jiechi met in Rome to hold talks over the ongoing conflict in Ukraine. The meeting took place behind closed doors and went on for 7 hours. No information was given to the media about the outcome. China has so far sought to portray itself as a neutral actor in the Ukraine crisis. However, Washington fears Beijing's willingness to take Russia's side following claims by a senior U.S. official that Moscow has asked China for military assistance. At the end of the meeting, a U.S. senior administration officer said Sullivan warned the Chinese top diplomats about the unity of the United States and its allies and partners in their efforts to stop Russia.
We believe that the response promptly given from all NATO allies are fully adequate to dispel any possible doubts about the alliance's determination to take the necessary steps to ensure the security of its citizens and its democracies.
China has responded to the U.S., saying reports that Russia has asked Beijing for military assistance for its Ukraine campaign are U.S. disinformation. Talks over the conflict in Ukraine were also held in the Italian capital between U.S. officials and Italian Prime Minister Mario Draghi's diplomatic advisers. According to some Italian media, Rome has so far played a minor role in the EU's management of the Ukraine crisis.
Italy always plays a minor role in all US and NATO initiatives, even though its importance is crucial considering that 12,000 US soldiers are deployed on our territory and some 100 nuclear missiles. Having said that, Italy is practically at war with Russia after sending weapons to Ukraine.
Meanwhile, Italy's health ministry announced Monday that around 35,000 Ukrainian refugees have arrived in the country so far. Most of them are women and children who have reached Italy through the border with Slovenia. Max Civili, Rome.
A court in India's southern state of Karnataka upholds a ban on hijab in schools amid fears of discrimination against the minority Muslim community. The court ruling says wearing the hijab is not an essential Islamic religious practice. The ruling comes weeks after statewide rival protests over the ban. The Muslim community there argues that girls have worn the hijab for decades, just as Hindus and Christians have observed their own symbols. But that has been met with a backlash from radical Hindu groups. Critics accuse authorities in Karnataka, which is ruled by the Hindu Nationalist Party, of seeking to drive a wedge between religious communities. India is home to some 200 million Muslims, and there are fears that such discrimination could spread to all parts of the country. We've asked London-based journalist and political commentator Sir Mohsin Abbas to share with us his assessment of the latest Indian court ruling against the hijab. Here's what he told us.
Part of a long litany of state-sponsored policies which target, discriminate, and basically treat Muslims as second-class citizens, essentially. What you've got is an Islamophobic establishment, the BJP, which rules the nation. You've got a leader of that nation who oversaw the Gujarat pogroms in which thousands of Muslims were murdered right under his watch without any kind of satisfactory comeback on that. You've seen the rise of cow killings. You know, individuals who are involved in the meat trade certainly can't operate anymore, and now there are lynchings that go on a regular basis without really any great pushback from the state. You've seen, of course, immigration laws which discriminate against Muslims as well. So what we're seeing here is really quite a deliberate attempt to erode Muslim status within a nation, as you say, which has such a large population, which is playing with fire.
Pakistan's main political religious party has held a press conference in the port city of Karachi on the new wave of Shia targeted killings in Pakistan. Mohammad Turi has more from Karachi.
Majlis-e-Wahdat-e-Muslimin is holding this emergency press conference after the same past patterns of Shia targeted killings emerged in the country, where killers either going scot-free or sectarian hate mongers are allowed to spread venom against Shia Muslims. Participants here say that the government of Prime Minister Imran Khan has miserably failed to make needed structural changes against hate mongering to root out this threat from the society. After the recent carnage in Peshawar Mosque, Shia-targeted killings gained momentum in the port city of Karachi, where leaders of Shia communities Pasmane Azhar Salman Haider was gunned down before his house, signalling another wave of Shia-targeted killing following the same decades-old patterns.
This press conference is about the start of new wave of targeted killings in Pakistan and the overall declining security situation in the country, which is evident that Khan administration at center has changed its priorities and cannot deliver on its promises. First in Quetta, then in Peshawar, and now targeted killing in Karachi. If enemy states are doing this, then where are our security institutions whose job is to safeguard Pakistani lives?
Participants of Salman Haider's funeral told Press TV that they do not feel secure on the streets anymore.
Imran Khan's government made promises to all Pakistanis to go against foreign-funded hate mongers and will implement National Action Plan in its full spirit to eradicate these sectarian elements from the country. But unfortunately, in the last 3 years, this government has done no implementation of the National Action Plan, and as a result, came this new wave of Shia-targeted killings across the country.
Shia Muslims have seen carnages in Pakistan over the last three decades. They believe it is the direct consequence of the Takfiri ideology promoted in Pakistan by certain regional states. Mohammad Turi, Karachi.
Israeli forces have killed three Palestinian youths hours apart as tensions run high across the occupied territories. 17-year-old Nader Rayan was shot dead during confrontations that took place at the Balata refugee camp east of Nablus. Three others were injured. Israeli forces have also killed another young Palestinian, alleging that he shot at a special force officer who was trying to arrest him in the Rahat area in Nagab. And the third victim was killed in a separate attack in Kalandia. Former Ramallah correspondent Mona Kandil has the details about the latest spate of violence in the occupied territories.
About three Palestinians were killed today in the occupied territories in three different incidents. The first in Balata refugee camp near Nablus, the second in the refugee camp of Qalandia near Ramallah, and the third in the town of Rahat in Al-Naqab, the Negev desert. Following the killing of those three Palestinians, Israeli military issued three statements claiming that the three operations were meant to arrest Palestinian suspects, whether in Nablus, in Qalandia, or even in Rahat, this town that was occupied by the Israelis in 1948. The Israelis said that in Nablus, the forces were confronted by the Palestinian youths who threw stones and rocks at the fully armed military forces. That's why Israeli forces opened fire, killing 17-year-old Nader Haytham Rayyam and wounding three others. One of them is in serious condition.
The UK Health Secretary has defended Britain's economic relations with Saudi Arabia just days after Riyadh executed a record 81 people in a single day. Sajid Javid says the UK government does not shy away from raising human rights issues with its partners, but that Riyadh is one of the world's largest oil producers. The UK Prime Minister Boris Johnson is planning to travel to Saudi Arabia this week to persuade Riyadh to increase its oil output. That is because Britain is looking for ways to end its dependence on Russian oil and gas over the war in Ukraine. But British MPs have called on Johnson to cancel his trip. Also, human rights groups are accusing Johnson of trying to trade oil for blood. Saudi Arabia faces international criticism for its poor human rights record, including the Yemen war and the killing of Saudi journalist Jamal Khashoggi. China is experiencing the worst outbreak of the coronavirus in 2 years, despite adhering to a zero-COVID strategy. Nearly 5,300 new daily infections have triggered lockdowns in 13 cities, and several other cities are under partial lockdowns. A total of 30 million people are under stay-at-home orders. Jilin is the worst affected province with over 3,000 new daily cases. The northeastern province has ordered travel restrictions and started making makeshift quarantine facilities to curb the outbreak. Also, dozens of domestic flights have been canceled at airports in Beijing and Shanghai. Health officials say tighter restrictions could be on the way. The surge is due to the highly transmissible Omicron variant spreading across the country. Iran has announced that only those who received at least two doses of COVID vaccines are allowed to travel by private cars during the Persian New Year holidays. This comes as the sixth wave of the coronavirus has subsided, but health specialists and officials are worried about the Persian New Year holidays, which are just around the country or corner. Saman Khujuri reports.
With the Persian New Year, or Nowruz, being just around the corner in Iran, people are getting prepared to welcome the arrival of spring. This comes as the sixth wave of coronavirus in Iran appears to have been subsiding now. The official daily number of fatalities, which had stood at 241 on February 27th, fell to below 120 over the past couple of days. The Persian New Year, or Nowruz, arrives on March 21st. The Nowruz holidays are traditionally a time when Iranians travel and visit each other. But health officials are worried that the exchange of visits and travels during the Persian New Year will lead to a new wave of COVID-19 if health protocols are not fully observed.
In view of the special feature of the Omicron variant, we highly request people to keep wearing masks and observe social distancing. Although many of them have been vaccinated, wearing a mask is still an important measure, especially when they are visiting relatives and friends during Nowruz.
I think everyone should receive the third dose of vaccine. And if you want to be safe, we should postpone our visiting and travels to some other time. If we don't take Omicron seriously, the next wave will sweep across the country again.
I have recovered from coronavirus almost 20 days now, but too much coughing hurts me a lot, and symptoms are still with me and my daughter. It's a bad disease, and people should not forget to observe the health protocols.
According to official statistics, over 56 million Iranians have received the second jabs of vaccines, while over 24 million others have been vaccinated with the third shot.
Under the travel rules released for Iran's third Nowruz with COVID-19, only those who have received at least two doses of vaccines are allowed to travel by their private cars across the country during the Persian New Year holidays. Otherwise, they will be fined. Saman Kujuri, Tehran.
And that is for this edition of World News. Bye-bye for now.
Comes from the heart of beautiful Iran.
Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. Assalamu alaykum wa rahmatullah.
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints.
Hame ba wujood قده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم.
All of us are opposed to the cancerous tumor Israel.
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی.
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
This is the part of a speech delivered on February 17, 2022 by Ayatollah Khamenei, the leader of the Islamic Revolution, via video conference with the participation of people from Tabriz and East Azerbaijan, commemorating the anniversary of the Tabriz uprising of February 18, 1978.
One achievement was scientific progress, and another is infrastructural progress. Of course, I do not intend to compare these. Those in charge of statistics should do so. But the comparison would be interesting and sweet. In the area of safe roads, highways, freeways, railways, dams, housing and water, electricity and gas supply to different parts of the country, the progress that has been made in these decades is amazing and very important progress. Had it not been for the revolution and the revolutionary movement and jihadi movement, these feats would certainly not have been achieved. Moreover, Iran has become a center of health and medical services in the region. In the past, for the smallest surgery, those who could and had the money would go abroad. However, today, people from countries in the region come to Iran for the most complex surgeries.
The world of Islam has one single prescription today, and that is unity. This prescription exists in all Islamic countries. Nations should be united.
Some of these services that have been done and the progress that has been made are really tens of times greater than what existed before the revolution. And these are very important. Well, these advances have been achieved. These are services that should not be disregarded. The same is true of the economy. I myself am one of the people who always criticizes us in economic matters. In the area of social justice, equitable distribution of wealth, in the field of relieving the deprivation of the weak classes and the like, I have certain complaints. But even in the area of the economy, the opinion of the well-known economic centers of the world is that Iran has made significant progress in important indicators of the economy, has taken great steps, and has made great moves. In addition, our self-sufficiency and the production of many things and the self-confidence of Iranian producers must be reflected. Of course, the national media has a great duty in this regard to reflect these, but they have not reflected them the way they should have. This is one of the necessary duties of the national media.
Allah, I want to thank you. I want to thank you for all the things that you've done for me through all my years. I've been lost. Guiding me from all the ways that were wrong. Indeed, you gave me hope. Oh, Allah, I wanna thank you. I wanna thank you for all the things that you've done. You've done for me through all my years. I've been lost. You've guided me from all.
Wildfires in Greece, Turkey, the United States.
Palestinian prisoners in Israeli jails continue to engage in hunger strikes.
Kim Yo-jong, the powerful sister of North Korean leader.
On the news line.
The UN Security Council meeting turned into a heated argument between Moscow and Washington. The US and Russian delegates exchanged accusations over alleged biological weapons in Ukraine. The Russian envoy warned the European countries of the danger posed by Ukraine's research into biological weapons. Russia says the US-funded biolabs have researched spreading the highly infectious bird flu virus through migratory birds and pathogens such as bacteria and viruses that can be transmitted from bats to humans. The US, however, rejected Russia's allegation of biological activities, claiming that biological laboratories in Ukraine have nothing to do with chemical arms. It also interpreted the accusation as a sign that Moscow plans to use chemical or biological weapons in Ukraine. Washington initially condemned Russia for spreading disinformation. Nevertheless, after Russia published documents showing that Kyiv was ordered to urgently eliminate traces of what was deemed as a biological weapons program financed by the Pentagon, U.S. Undersecretary of State Victoria Nuland admitted the existence of U.S.-funded biological research facilities in the country, saying Washington is working with Kyiv to prevent Russia from getting the research materials. The contradictory remarks further deepen the world's doubts about the U.S. Why is the U.S. hastily attempting to destroy the materials? Is it trying to hide something?
Well, first of all, the United States specializes in moving its chemical and biological weapons activities away from its own territory to allow itself a degree of deniability. In other words, we didn't do that. It was a private venture of an academic institute or of a government department not related to the militaries.
The United States has spent more than $200 million on the work of biological laboratories in Ukraine.
It has 30 biological laboratories and other related facilities in the country which are possibly involved in the production of bioweapons. And these are less than 10% of the 336 biological laboratories the U.S. reportedly controls in 30 countries around the world. Deputy Chairman of the Council of Ministers of Crimea, Georgi Muradov, says the United States had plans to open a biolab on the peninsula before its annexation to Russia. He also accused the Pentagon of developing biological weapons in its secret laboratories under Ukrainian territory. Also, China has called on the United States to release all-around details of its biological laboratories in Ukraine and urged relevant parties to ensure their safety. The U.S. has blocked the building of the Biological Weapons Convention Verification Protocol for 2 decades and refused to accept inspections of biological facilities within and outside its borders, despite having over 300 biological laboratories all over the world. It seems that by doing so, the U.S. wants to protect the secrets of its biological labs worldwide. It's reasonable and legitimate for the international community to question the U.S. for that, especially since it has a history of using chemical weapons. The U.S. dropped massive quantities of white phosphorus on the Iraqi city of Fallujah during an attack on the city in November 2004, killing insurgents and civilians with the appalling burns that are the signature of this weapon. Also, 5 decades after the Vietnam War ended, Agent Orange continues to impact communities in Vietnam and Laos today. It contained dioxin, one of the most toxic chemicals known to humans. It is linked to increased rates of cancers and birth defects. Vietnam says several million people have been affected by Agent Orange, including 150,000 children born with severe birth defects.
Well, the United States has always managed to present two faces to the world. One is the face of the American democracy attempting to achieve peace according to their propaganda, and the other is the military-industrial complex that runs the American economy by making wars. So the political element of the U.S. system denies involvement in such activities, while behind the back of the public, even the American public, is deceived in order to keep the regime popular at home. But behind the back of the American public, the United States is more involved than any other country in the world in these areas.
Biological weapons are seen as weapons of mass destruction together with nuclear and chemical weapons. Any suspicion of biological weapons must be promptly investigated. Therefore, the U.S. owes the world an answer on what it has been up to in its so-called biological research facilities in Ukraine.
September 11, 2001. The United States is hit by 4 coordinated terrorist attacks, the first major assault on the U.S. soil since World War II. Nearly 3,000 people are killed and some 20,000 others injured. The U.S. responds with an all-out war on Afghanistan, where the terror group Al-Qaeda that planned and carried out the attack was said to be based. Fast forward 20 years. U.S. President Joe Biden signed an executive order in September giving the Justice Department a 6-month notice to release the documents on the FBI's investigations into the incident. Yet on Thursday, the department acknowledged that it would miss the deadline, suggesting that they would be released by mid-April. It says the delay is due to continuing coordination with a number of foreign governments and ongoing interagency review. One of the governments in question is likely to be Saudi Arabia. Out of 19 terrorists involved in the attacks, 15 were Saudi nationals. The close ties between Al-Qaeda leader Osama bin Laden and the Saudi royal family also raised questions that Saudi Arabian authorities supported the operation. Some observers believe the conflict in Ukraine and the West's sweeping sanctions on Russia, especially its energy sector, which has sent fuel prices skyrocketing around the world, could explain the delay in the release of the documents, as the United States needs Saudi Arabia, with the world's second largest oil reserves, to fill in the gap.
And obviously there's a quid pro quo going on here. How serious it's going to be is another question. You still got hanging over all of this the fact that Vice President Cheney at the time, in 9/11, arranged for all these Saudis to leave the country, leave the United States and go back to Saudi Arabia. So there was no follow-up at the time, contemporaneously, with the Saudi presence in the United States, or the fact that most of the people who were involved in the actual hijackings of these planes were Saudis. So clearly there is something here that is extremely troubling. And clearly the Saudis do not want this out. And I suspect there are large sections of the United States government who are not interested in having a serious discussion about this.
But the delay isn't good news to thousands of families who are seeking justice for the loved ones they lost on 9/11. Soon after taking office, Joe Biden said the U.S. was ending all its support for Saudi Arabia's war on Yemen, proclaiming that the war has to end. But, back in September, the U.S. State Department approved its first major arms sale to the kingdom under President Biden, with the sale of 280 air-to-air missiles valued at up to $650 million. President Biden has broken another promise about defending humanitarian rights, an issue he staked much of his presidency on. Back in February, a declassified U.S. intelligence report concluded that Saudi Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman authorized a team of Saudi security and intelligence officials to kill dissident journalist Jamal Khashoggi in 2018. But Biden later decided not to punish bin Salman, saying it would be diplomatically unprecedented for the United States.
It's unlikely that people are going to support the United States in the hour of need without some concessions. I mean, I just don't see it. It's possible, I suppose. Maybe there's some threats or whatever, but it's unlikely. And the Saudis have been very clear in the paper today. They said they want more support by the United States for their adventure in Yemen, among other things. There was a list.
The U.S. takes in stride the violations perpetrated by its allies while accusing countries it deems its adversaries of the same charges. But will it forgive possible perpetrators of attacks on its own citizens too? What message would that have for the attackers? Wouldn't that embolden them to commit even worse crimes, knowing that they can get away with murder in its most literal sense?
As the war between Russia and Ukraine drags on, there are indications that Ukraine has hosted U.S.-funded labs to develop biological weapons. U.S. Undersecretary of State for Political Affairs Victoria Nuland has admitted that Ukraine hosts biological research facilities.
Ukraine has biological research facilities, which, in fact, we are now quite concerned Russian troops, Russian forces may be seeking to gain control of. So we are working with the Ukrainians on how they can prevent any of those research materials from falling into the hands of Russian forces.
So that Victoria Nuland, the guru of the Maidan, who was passing out cookies to the fascist Azov battalion in 2014 during the coup against the legitimate government, was forced to admit that these facilities were there. She didn't clarify what they were exactly, but she indicated that that they were dismantled quickly in order to prevent them from falling into the hands of the Russians.
The admission came after Russia published documents showing that Kiev was ordered to urgently eliminate traces of what was deemed as a biological weapons program financed by the Pentagon. The dangerous pathogens across Ukrainian biolab facilities included anthrax, the plague, tularemia, cholera, and other deadly diseases. In the past several days, long-standing fears, which we have expressed repeatedly for years, regarding the development of military biological materials by the United States on the territory of Ukraine under the auspices of the relevant U.S. Special Services have been confirmed. Earlier, the Russian Defense Ministry said it had found evidence of U.S.-funded biolabs in Ukraine, which had urgently destroyed samples of deadly pathogens when the military offensive started.
I think the United States was caught by surprise now. At first, they've been denying all the accusations that are being made, you know, over the past few months that they're conducting biological warfare research. You had this incident here, which initially they really couldn't deny.
Russia says U.S. statements about Ukraine's biolabs indicate fears by Washington that the pathogens stored there may fall into the hands of Russian experts. Moscow says they confirmed the U.S.'s violation of the Biological and Toxin Weapons Convention.
So either through surrogate or directly, the United States seems to have been involved in creating a capability that would give a country, an allied country, or the United States a possibility to conduct biological warfare. And that, of course, is forbidden by a variety of U.N. conventions.
Russia says it had been closely monitoring the bioweapons programs that were developed by the Pentagon in post-Soviet countries. Russia has accused the U.S. of working in Ukraine since 2005 and being involved in the construction, modernization, and operation of over a dozen biolabs suitable for storing or working with pathogens, including those used in bioweapons.
The fact that they existed in Ukraine, where there was a almost obsessive concern and hatred, I must say, among some of the leading factions, right-wing factions in the Ukrainian government against Russia, that they, I think, would be quite prepared to use them in a war with someone they considered their deadly foe. And if they did so, it was with the full backing of the United States, who set up these facilities in the first place.
Moscow has expressed deep concerns about these facilities in recent years. Moscow says facilities in Ukraine were developing components for biological weapons, noting that in the near future, the ministry would release its analysis of the received documents. Russia also accuses the U.S. of sponsoring biological labs across a number of former Soviet republics, including Kazakhstan, Armenia, Tajikistan, and Georgia.
The Aerospace Force of Iran's Islamic Revolution Guards Corps successfully put a reconnaissance satellite into orbit. The Noor-2 was launched from Imam Khomeini Spaceport in Semnan Province. The satellite reached a low orbit of 500 kilometers above the Earth on an Iranian three-stage Cossett carrier, which used a combination of liquid and solid fuels. The Noor-2 became Iran's second military satellite successfully placed in low Earth orbit. Commander of the Space Command of the IRGC's Aerospace Force said Iran's national space and defense organizations, knowledge-based companies, and universities cooperated in the Noor-2 project. Brigadier General Ali Jafarabadi explained that the domestically manufactured satellite incorporates the newest technology. It is the upgraded version of Noor-1, which was launched into orbit 21 months ago. Data obtained by Iran's second military satellite can have multiple general and defensive uses. The Noor-2 will orbit the Earth every 90 minutes and will pass over the Iranian sky 16 times every day. Its mission will last at least 3 years. The commander explained that the IRGC will launch a series of Noor satellites in the coming years to consolidate its position in low Earth orbit before aiming for the orbit 36,000 kilometers above land. The latest achievements of Iran's space program came a few days after the IRGC unveiled two underground bases housing state-of-the-art missiles and attack drones.
Oh!
Iran has been relentlessly developing new weapons and military equipment, arguing that it needs the means to defend itself in the world's most volatile region. Just weeks ago, the country unveiled a state-of-the-art ballistic missile with pinpoint precision. Khaybar Shekan boasts high maneuverability when it dives down, making it a nightmare for the world's most advanced missile shields. Iranians have stressed that their defense program grew out of the war initiated by Iraqi dictator Saddam Hussein in the 1980s. Saddam's forces showered Iranian cities with missiles and bombs provided by the East and the West, while Iranians say no one sold them any proper means of defense. Iranians argue that they have no choice but to build their own defense industry. The latest achievement strongly suggests that Iran's pursuit of robust defense capabilities is in full swing despite stringent American sanctions.
I think that these developments send several interrelated messages, the first and foremost being that Iran's technological development will not be held back by the obviously failed efforts of the United States and its allies to curtail Iranian technological development. It sends another similar message regarding sanctions, that sanctions are going to be completely ineffectual in terms of holding back Iran's scientific as well as industrial development.
Iran is still engaged in the negotiations in the Austrian capital aimed at removing the sanctions, but its defense industries are not waiting for the talks to end in an agreement. Observers believe Iran's launch of a military satellite into orbit as talks in Vienna are still underway is sending a clear message that it will never negotiate over its defense capabilities and that no agreement can ever restrict its defense, missile, and space programs. The Islamic Republic has made it clear that it will never ask for permission from anyone to manufacture its own means of defense.
IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
تمام ارزش‌ها و صفاتی که انسان احترام میگذاره همه این ارزش ها در علی ابن ابی طالب جمعه.
Human in general, whether a Muslim, non-Muslim, or even a disbeliever, respect the values present in the character of Ali ibn Abi Talib.
لا يقيم امر الله سبحانه الا من لا يصانع ولا يضارع ولا يتبع المطامع.
امام علي عليه الصلاه والسلام, the reason we love him as our hero, or not only in the material sense, in the spiritual sense, in the leadership sense.
The universal persona of Imam Ali alayhi salam in To My Brother. Imam Ali alayhi salam, the most distinguished and extraordinary personality in Islam after the Holy Prophet Muhammad. His entire life is a struggle for the advancement of Islam, the universal religion prescribed by Allah for all of humanity. Imam Ali alayhi salam was the living miracle raised up by the Holy Prophet Muhammad himself, and was not only the successor and the executor of the Holy Prophet Muhammad, but as history testifies, he was also a great human being, a brave defender of Islam, a just and fair judge, a generous philanthropist, a champion of the people, and the most pious person of his time. And in today's world, overcome by evil and darkness, and oppression and slavery, and tyranny and falsehood, a quick look into this beacon of truth and justice, a look into the universal persona of Imam Ali, is greatly useful for making and changing our lives, our families, our societies, and our world into the beautiful world that Allah has planned for humanity.
قال أمير المؤمنين علي عليه السلام: قليل مدوم عليه خير من كثير مملول منه.
أمير المؤمنين إمام علي عليه السلام stated: A little that lasts is better than much that brings grief.
Welcome back, dear friends. It's wonderful to have you with us. This is IRIB English Radio, the programs to my brother, and we were discussing the universal persona of Imam Ali ibn Abi Talib alayhi salam. So, dear friends, in these recent episodes, we've been talking about how His Eminence, the first divinely appointed Imam, the living miracle of the Holy Prophet Muhammad sallallahu alayhi wa alayhi wa sallam, Imam Ali alayhi salam has shown us a certain kind of lifestyle. It's interesting, this is the same lifestyle of the Prophet Muhammad sallallahu alayhi wa alayhi wa sallam. And of course, this is the same lifestyle of Amir al-Mu'mineen, the commander of the faithful, Imam Ali. And likewise, we see that this lifestyle is the same, and it is continuous, and it is repetitive, it is the same, it is stable amongst all of the infallible imams. And so when we say that this is a lifestyle of Imam Ali alayhi salam, this means this is the lifestyle and the manners and the seerah and the sunnah and the akhlaq, the morals, the ways of all of the infallible imams, and they, of course, have taken this lifestyle, this Islamic lifestyle, if you will, from the Messenger of Allah. In one of these instances, Imam Ali alayhi salam says to us that one of the things which can help an individual is during hard times to hope for a solution. Again, during hard times, one should hope for a solution. Now, when Imam Ali alayhi salam here, he's saying that we should hope for a solution when in hard times, of course, this does not mean that in these kind of hard times, we don't do anything. We just sit down and we just plainly hope and pray that everything gets fixed. No, rather, we should and we must work to get ourselves out of a hard situation. We must actively plan and strategize and work and, you know, help ourselves and try to get out of these hard times and difficult situations. So we must act. We must do something. But there is a very interesting psychological, spiritual aspect here. And that is that if you are hopeless, then no matter how much you act, it won't be as good as if you were hopeful for a solution in hard times, right? So, for example, when you don't have hope that a solution will present itself or that you will be able to overcome a hard situation or a hard time or a hard condition, because of that hopefulness, your action becomes weak. But on the other hand, when you are hopeful that there is a solution, you are hopeful that Allah will help you, you are hopeful that you can overcome a certain situation, then this gives you the spiritual strength and, for lack of a better word, the psychological strength to be able to overcome the hard times that you are faced with. So, another profound lesson. hoping for a solution in hard times, brought to us by the universal persona of Imam Ali, alayhi salam.
تبقى عيني بدمع مشتاقيا قد لسعت حية الهوى كبدي فلا تبيب لها ولا راغي
تمام ارزش‌ها و صفاتی که انسان چه به عنوان انسان مؤمن به اسلام چه به عنوان انسان مؤمن به هر دینی
human in general whether a muslim non-muslim or even a disbeliever respect the values present in the character of Ali ibn Abi Talib. This means Ali ibn Abi Talib is a global character who is respected by Sunnis, Shias, and even non-Muslims. Everyone, even the faithless people, respect Imam Ali and his personal values.
In the name of Allah, Assalamu alaikum, dear brothers and sisters. Welcome to this segment of To My Brother. My name is Muhammad. After returning from the Battle of Siffin, Imam Ali gave certain pieces of advice to one of his sons. Historians consider him to be Imam Hassan alayhi salam, while others are of the opinion that he was Muhammadul Hanafiyya. He wrote this letter in the form of a will. They deal with almost every aspect of life, which goes a long way to make a man successful in life, brave, humane, generous, virtuous, and pious. Today, I'm going to read to you an excerpt from the last will of Imam Ali alayhi salam. Please stay with us. My dear son, from the very beginning, I took care to help you to develop a noble character and to fit you for the life which you have to lead, to let you grow up to be a young man with a noble character, an open and honest mind, and clear and precise knowledge of things around you. Originally, my desire was only to teach you the holy book thoroughly, to make you understand its intricacies, to impart to you the complete knowledge of its commandments and interdictions, and not to leave you at the mercy of the knowledge of other people. But after having succeeded in this task, I felt nervous that I may leave you untrained and uneducated in the subjects which themselves are subject to so much confusion and so many contradictions. These are the subjects whose confusions have been made worse, confounded by selfish desires, warped minds, wicked ways of life, and sinful modes of thinking. Therefore, I have noted down in these lines the basic principles of nobility, piety, truth, and justice. You may feel them to be overbearing and harsh, but my desire is to equip you with this knowledge instead of leaving you unarmed to face the world where there is every danger of loss and damnation. As you are a noble, virtuous, and pious young man, I am sure you will receive divine guidance and succor. I am sure he will help you achieve your aim in life. I want to promise to yourself to follow my advice carefully.
Now we invite you to listen to Sayyid Muhammad Ridhvi.
There is another very interesting, conversation of this type. And let me start with Sahih Bukhari here. Sahih Bukhari, in the narration of the peace treaty that the Prophet signed with the Mushrikeen of Mecca, has a discussion there where just one sentence from there, where he says to Ali, "Anta minni." وَعَنَا مِنْكَ. Remember yesterday we talked about Surah Barat, that Jibreel came down and he said to Rasulullah that either you take this Surah Barat to the Mushrikeen of Mecca to announce it, أَوْ رَجُلٌ مِنْكَ, or somebody who is from you. This is another incident where the Prophet is saying, أَنْتَ مِنِّي, O Ali, you are from me. وَعَنَا مِنْكَ, and I am from you. The first one is easy to understand, just like the famous statements, Husayn minni wa ana min Husayn. The first one is very easy to understand, the second one is the where you have to think about it. Ahmad bin Hanbal also in his Musnad says the same statement from Rasulullah, where he says, Aliyun minni wa ana minhu. Ali is from me and I am from Ali. This relationship is so important that you cannot separate them. That is where when we say, Ashhadu an la ilaha illallah wa Muhammadun Rasulullah wa Aliyun Waliullah wa Khalifatuhu bila fasl. You can't separate there and have, 1, 2, 3 in between. No. It is Rasul and then bila fasl, immediately then the successor is Ali. First time. After the wafat of Rasulullah, and this is again the early days of Khilafat, when the people accepted him as the Khalifa, he comes into the masjid and sits on the minbar of Rasulullah. These minbars are different. This is what we just call symbolically. But that was actually the minbar of Rasulullah, the real one. Amirul Mu'mineen goes there first time, goes into the minbar right away at the top. And this is where the Ummah is saying, oh, what is this? This is almost 24 years after wafat of Rasulullah. Look at the answer now. When now he is told why people are, talking to one another, there is murmuring going on, he responds. And his response is, سَمِعْتُ رَسُولِ اللَّهِ يَقُولُ. He says, I heard the Prophet saying, مَنْ قَامَ مَقَامِ. Whoever stands in my place, whoever takes my place, وَلَمْ يَعْمَلْ بِعَمَلِي, and doesn't act according to my sunnah and my actions, أَكَبَّهُ اللَّهُ فِي النَّارِ, Allah will throw him into the fire of Jahannam. وَعَنَا وَاللَّهِ, and by Allah, as far as I am concerned, الْعَامِلْ بِعَمَلِهِ, I act according to the actions of Rasulullah and his sunnah. Al-mumtasilu qawluhu. I implement his instructions and his sayings. Al-hakimu bihukmihi. And I give verdicts according to the judgment of Rasulullah sallallahu alayhi wa sallam. Falidhalika qumtu huna. Therefore I am sitting and taking this place of Rasulullah.